Testing 1, 2, 3 now. All right, we're going to talk about joy tonight. No, I'm just kidding. we're going to talk about the unjust steward. It was supposed to be Brad preaching tonight, so sorry for those of you who showed up looking for Brad. But he was feeling a little bit under the weather, and I had just done this lesson a couple weeks ago at Rocky Point, so I said, I'll be glad to do it. And come back next Sunday, listen to another good lesson from him. The parable of the unjust steward is it's one of those parables that I don't think we hear a lot of lessons on. It's kind of a hard one because it seems that it appears to be about a steward who cheats his master and is commended by Jesus for being a liar and a thief. And that's difficult, and we look for lessons out of that. excuse me, I want to read a little bit from the commentary in the ESV Bible that I use about this. Concerning verse 8, the master commended the dishonest manager. Various explanations have been suggested for this seemingly undeserved commendation. One, in giving the discounts, the manager had excluded any commission for himself, but the discount seemed too high for that to have been the case. Two, the debts were hard to collect, and by reducing the amounts, the manager provided a sudden influx of cash for his master. I've heard that one. I'm sure y'all have too. Or three, the master commended the manager for his shrewdness in looking out for himself, but this does not mean that the master praises him for his evil. In any case, the details of the parable should not be pressed, for a parable often makes only one major point. And here the main point is that the manager had great foresight to anticipate his financial needs after his dismissal, thus using his financial expertise to make friends for himself. Now, I think there is, that's part of it. I do think that that's part of it. But I think it's missing the greater point. And I guess I should have said this a minute ago, but I've been studying a book by a guy named Kenneth Bailey on the life of Jesus, and he talks a lot about Jesus' parables, among other things. And my lesson is primarily coming from that tonight. So I do not claim to stand here and say, hey, I've got this brand new insight that I guarantee some of you, maybe some of you have heard what I'm going to suggest is going on here, but I'm sure that many of you have not. I'd never heard it. But it's not my original thought, so I don't want to claim that. you know, the songs that Reagan sang tonight had to do with God's love. And what's interesting is if you look back in Luke chapter 15, Luke chapter 15 ends with the parable of the prodigal son. And you know, Jesus didn't put these chapter divisions there. The people who put the New Testament together, they put these chapter divisions there. And notice in verse 1 of chapter 16, it says, he also said to the disciples, and then he goes into the parable of the dishonest steward. So these two are, he tells these two right together. And I'm already behind on my slides, I see. They don't want to switch either. Good grief. I worked hard on this. I don't even normally do PowerPoints. All right. I'm just trying to do it this way. So this quote, the parable of the unjust steward may almost be regarded as an appendix to the parable of the prodigal son. I don't know who T.W. Manson is, but he's somebody who was smart enough to get quoted in the book I was reading. So just giving credit where it's due there. there are actually several similarities between these two parables. And since my PowerPoint's not working, instead of dramatically revealing them one at a time, we'll just go there. So there's a noble master in each one. The prodigal son, obviously, it's the father. And they both extend extraordinary grace to a wayward underling. You know, you remember when Roger Shouse was here, he made this point that in the prodigal son, when the son comes to the father and says, "Give me my inheritance," he's telling him, "I wish that you were dead." I mean, it is tremendously insulting what the younger son comes and says to his father. And I don't know that we necessarily pick up on that, but I should have said one other thing about this book I'm reading by Kenneth Bailey. He lived in the Middle East and taught in universities over there for about 40 years. And so his perspective is not only from one who has lived over there for a long time, but also has spoken to a lot of people who are natives of the Middle East. And he also quotes a lot of commentaries by Arabic commenters. You know, we don't hold all the scholarship on the Bible. There's a lot around the world, and he quotes from people who were writing 1,000 years ago about the New Testament. And so it's pretty interesting. All right, in both parables, each of the underlings, you know, the son and the steward, they reach a moment of truth regarding where they are in their life. And this fourth point, this one might, and I think I'm going to prove this, in both cases, the son/steward throws himself on the mercy of the noble master. That's the thing I don't know that we always see in the second parable. And then both parables deal with broken trust and the problems resulting from it. So if you look at these similarities, maybe if that chapter division wasn't there, it maybe we'd have a different understanding of the parable of the unjust steward. Brent never had problems like this. I'm sure I'm doing something wrong. So... Again, fortunately, we're only going to be using this for a minute. But one of the things that Jesus does in his teaching is the rhetoric that he uses is not just stuff off the cuff. I mean, there's logic to it, and we don't talk this way these days. Most of us probably don't do any writing at all. The ones who do, I don't know that we put as much thought into it. But it's pretty interesting when you look at the parables and see how he told these stories and the logic that he uses. So this prophetic rhetorical template is a term that Kenneth Bailey came up with. And Luke chapter 12, if you want to turn over there, is the parable about the person wanting to build bigger barns. In verse 16, it says, "And he told them a parable, saying, The land of a rich man produced plentifully, and he thought to himself, What shall I do, for I have nowhere to store my crops? And he said, I will do this. I will tear down my barns and build larger ones, and there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I will say to my soul, Soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years. Relax, eat, drink, be merry. But God said to him, Fool, this night your soul is required of you, and the things you have prepared, whose will they be? So is the one who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God." So in this, you can see the... if you look at the first point up there, it is a general principle that Jesus gives them. The last point is also a general principle. All right, the second point in the parable, goods were given to the rich man. In the second to the last point, goods were taken away. The next one at the top, he had a dialogue with himself saying, okay, what am I going to do? And then point number five here, He has another dialogue with himself. Okay, I've done what I was going to do. Now I'm going to enjoy myself. And in the middle, the very middle of it, the fourth point is where he comes up with a solution. And a lot of Jesus' parables have this format, where the turning point, the critical part, is right in the middle. And then there's some parallels or sometimes some direct contrasts as you go out from the middle. One of the parables that Jesus tells, it's really interesting because he uses this format, but then when he gets to what should be the seventh point, instead of it directly mirroring the first point, he actually does the same thing with seven more points in one verse. I mean, it's marvelous to read, and again, I'm not smart enough to pick this stuff out myself, but as I'm studying people who are smart enough, it's really interesting to see that there may be some things that we don't always pick up when we're just reading through the text. Well, in the unjust steward, it's not quite the same. Instead of the 1-2-3-4-3-2-1, he uses 1-2-2-3-4-4-5. So there's not direct parallels. And I'm sorry, I'm just not even getting it all. You can't hardly read it. But the opening point has the steward and the master. The closing point has the steward and the master. Then the next two parallel, where the steward is thinking about what he's losing. He's losing his job. And trying to figure out what he's going to do. Then the middle point, he's got a solution. I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to, and then verse 5 and 6 is where he gains things back again because of the decision that he's made. So, again, it's not critical to our understanding, but it's interesting to see that when Jesus told these parables, there was a method to it. And I highly recommend, studies like this where we're, for me, like I said, I'm learning a lot of stuff that I didn't know. All right, that's it about the parable. As I said, that's my last slide. My computer will probably go to sleep here in a second, so just we'll move on from that. Now let's read this, beginning in Luke chapter 16, verse 1. It says, "He also said to the disciples, there was a rich man who had a manager. And charges were brought to him that this man was wasting his possessions. And he called him and said to him, 'What is this that I hear about you? Turn in the account of your management, for you can no longer be manager.' And the manager said to himself, 'What shall I do, since my master is taking the management away from me? I'm not strong enough to dig, and I'm ashamed to beg. I have decided what to do, so that when I'm removed from management, people may receive me into their houses.' So, summoning his master's debtors one by one, he said to the first, 'How much do you owe my master?' He said, 100 measures of oil. He said to him, 'Take your bill and sit down quickly and write 50. Then he said to another, 'And how much do you owe?' He said, 100 measures of wheat. He said to him, 'Take your bill and write 80. The master commended the dishonest manager for his shrewdness, for the sons of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own generation than the sons of light. Now, if you've got paragraphs in your Bible, I want to say one other thing here. Verse 9 in my Bible is part of that paragraph. But Bailey suggests, and I can see this, that verse 9 would actually go better with the next paragraph rather than this parable. Verse 9 says, "And I tell you, make friends for yourselves by means of unrighteous wealth, so that when it fails, they may receive you into the eternal dwellings." And then in verse 11, he's talking about unrighteous wealth and goes on to talk about serving God and two masters. You can't do it. So I'm not going to be talking about verse 9 because I don't think that fits with the parable here. All right, so we've got three characters basically in the parable, at least at the beginning. We've got the master, and we've got the steward. And if you know anything about the stewardship in the New Testament, if someone was a steward, then they had all the authority of the master. They would handle buying and selling. They had complete authority of the master. And then we've got a third character that we're not introduced to, and that's probably the master's peers, his friends. Somebody comes to him. He says in verse 2, "What is this that I hear about you?" Somebody came to the master and said, "Your steward is stealing from you." So we don't know who that is. The fact that the master doesn't question the steward, he just accepts it as fact, indicates it's probably someone at the master's level and not like a fellow servant. So he comes to him and says, "Look, I know this is what you're doing. Now, one thing that's interesting about Jesus' parables, when there's two major characters and one is ignoble, the other one is always righteous. And we don't see anything in this parable about the master being unrighteous or any shades of gray. The master is the righteous person in this parable, and the unjust steward is a wicked and deceitful person. Verse 2 says, he called him and said to him, "What is this that I hear about you? Turn in the account of your management, for you can no longer be manager." There's actually, and I'm not going to get into Greek here, but the way it reads in the Greek, he's telling him, turn in the books. Give me the accounting books. And so what he's doing here is he's firing him on the spot. Like, you're fired. You're not gonna be able to work for me anymore. So from rabbinic sources, again, people in the Middle East, what's going on here? Once he is fired, he loses any ability to make deals. Anything that he does from this point on is not binding on the master at all. But what else is going on here? Who knows that he's been fired? The only person who knows is the master. So this is just between the two of them at this point. So even though he can't make any more binding deals, no one else knows that except the master. Now, something else that's interesting here, what is his response to the master? He doesn't respond to the master. And again, one of the things that Bailey says is the idea in the Middle East that someone would lose their job without saying a word, without begging, without trying to get their influential friends to go and talk to the master on their behalf, that just wouldn't, that doesn't happen. That doesn't happen in the Middle East. And there's a saying, I'm sure some of you have heard it, that in the Middle East, no is simply, the word no is simply a pause in negotiations. So the fact that the steward does not offer any kind of defense, but accepts it, what that's telling us about the master is he's someone who is not going to be moved. His character is such that the steward realizes there's no point in trying to hold on to my job. And it's also an admission of guilt. It's also an admission of guilt on his part. He knows that he knows what he's done, and he knows there's no changing the master's mind. So he does not try to do that. So, and this is an important point in the parable right here. So at this point, he's an ex-manager who still has the books, but he's been fired. So verse 3 is kind of an honest appraisal of himself. He says, I'm not strong enough to dig, and I'm ashamed to beg. So what am I going to do? Verse 4, he decides he wants to work for someone else, but how is he going to make it happen? So, you know, once it's known that he was fired for being a thief, he's going to have a very difficult time getting a job, because who is knowingly going to hire someone who was just recently fired for stealing? No one would do that. But he's got some time. He still has the books. The master didn't say, you know, didn't go with him. He said, go and bring me the book. So he's got time to do something. And what is it that he decides to do? I don't know that we always get exactly what he's doing here. I certainly didn't until I was studying this. Verse 5, so summoning his master's debtors one by one, he said to the first, how much do you owe my master? He said, 100 measures of oil. He said to him, take your bill and sit down quickly and write 50. Then he said to another, and how much do you owe? He said, 100 measures of wheat. He said to him, take your bill and write 80. Now, there's several interesting things that are going on here. And this is what I was talking about that I don't know that I always understood. He's stealing again. What he's doing, he's stealing again from his master. These are, and the situation seems to be, you know, measures of oil, wheat. It seems that the master owns a farm, and he's got farmers there working for him, and they're in debt to him. He lets them work the land, and they get a percentage of what they grow, but it's his land. And so when the unrighteous steward calls these people in and says, take your bill and write down less than what you owe, he's stealing again from the master. Now think about that for a minute. How much gall would that take? If you've caught someone who's stealing and you've confronted them and said, I am firing you for stealing, but because of the circumstances, they've got some time, and they go and steal some more. Is that normally what happens? I know I wouldn't do that. If I got fired for stealing, I'm going to slink out of there on my belly. I'm not going to be stealing more, but this guy does. He actually steals more, and it's not an insignificant amount. Each one of these markdowns that he tells them to take was actually about 500 denarii, worth about 500 denarii. So almost right about a year and a half's worth of work is how much. So it's a vast amount that he has the nerve to steal again from the master. Now, this next point is coming directly from Middle Eastern commentaries. So I've never heard this before, and if you want to dismiss this one, that's fine with me. It doesn't make any difference in the understanding of the parable, but I think it's interesting. Middle Eastern commentaries make the point that something else that's going on is this is a deal between the debtors and the manager. So when he tells the first one, take your bill and write down 50 about the oil, they're actually splitting that other 50. So that the manager is going to take 50 or 25, and the debtor is going to take 25 as well. And so that kind of makes the debtor, it gets them as partners in this crime, which is, it's going to help the manager, because it's going to prevent the debtor from going and telling the master, hey, let me tell you what he's doing now. He was stealing before. He's really stealing now. Well, this guy's taking a deal, and he's implicit now. He's not gonna go to the master. He also tells him, again in verse 6, take your bill and sit down quickly and write 50. Why does he have the debtor write down in the accounting books what the amount is? That's an interesting point. And we'll talk about that in just a minute, what that does for him. So when the debtor leaves, he goes back to his farming house, the village there, and says, you're not going to believe this, but I was just up at the master's mansion, and I met with the steward, and the master has reduced our debt by 500 denarii. Can you believe that? How would you feel in a situation like that? I can tell you, if our bank called me tomorrow and said, hey, in a fit of generosity, we are reducing your mortgage by 5 years. We just want to let you know. I'm not going to sit quietly in my office. I'm first going to call Beverly and say, you're never going to believe this. And then I'm going to go through the office saying, y'all won't believe the phone call I just got. The bank is reducing our mortgage by 5 years. This is out. I mean, we're gonna have a party. It's gonna be awesome. That's what would have happened when these guys went back and said, guess what? He just reduced the debt that we owe by 500 denarii, and there was great rejoicing. There would have been great rejoicing about that. So then we come to verse 8. The master commended the dishonest manager for his shrewdness, is what the ESV says. Now, one of the things that the master is going to see when the guy hands him the books, he's going to see the handwriting that the markdowns were written in. What that's going to tell him is this has already been communicated. It's not that the dishonest manager was planning to do this. This is done. This is done. And so the master, he's like everybody else. He knows what's going on now down in the village. people are thrilled to death because of his generosity. And so he's faced with a choice. He's been stolen from again. He just found out that this guy has stolen from him again. He understands that his tenants are celebrating his generosity because he reduced their debts. So what can he do? He's got a couple things. One goes back to the point I made a few minutes ago that this deal actually is illegal. And the master can go to the villagers and say, hey, stop the party. I just want to tell you, I'm sorry to say this, but I fired him before he made those deals. And so this whole debt reduction thing is not actually true. You still owe that. How do you think you'd feel if you got that second phone call from the bank? Mr. Malloy, we're sorry. That was a mistake. We didn't actually reduce your mortgage by 5 years. And I've already told everybody. And I'm going to be irritated. You know, I'm going to be seriously irritated. Why in the world did you call me then? What kind of incompetent people do you have there when you're making phone calls like this? I'm going to be angry. So the master realizes that that's what's going on. So that's one choice. He can go down there and tell them, hey, it's null and void. You still owe it. Or he could let the celebration continue as it enhances, but not creates. It enhances his reputation as a generous man. So let's think about that for a minute. What could the master have done when he first heard that the steward was stealing from him? He fired him, but what could he have done? He could have put him in debtor's prison. He could have sold him to help pay for the debt. He could have sold the man's family to help pay the debt. But he didn't, because that's not who that master is. This master is a generous and merciful master. He didn't even make it a public spectacle. He fired the guy in private. The dishonest steward understands that. He understands that is the type of person that I'm dealing with here. And so when he was trying to figure out what to do, I think what Jesus is teaching here is that he said, you know what? I know what kind of master I've got here. And if I steal from him again to help make a landing place for me, I've lost this job, I want to work in someone else's house so I can make these deals. What risk was he taking on there? He was taking on tremendous risk because he's already been caught stealing once, he's been fired for it, and then he goes to steal again. The risk is he's going to lose everything. Why would you take a risk like that? Because he knew the nature of his master. He knew that man was generous and kind and merciful. And he wasn't going to go down to that village and say, I'm sorry, everybody. You still owe me all this money. This master was a good enough person that he was willing to endure that hurt and take that loss himself rather than go down and tell all those people and upset them and disappoint them. Jesus is not commending this guy for being a liar and a thief and telling his disciples, you need to be like this man. You need to be shrewd like this liar and a thief. He's not saying that. What Jesus is telling them is, this man recognized how loving and kind the master was. And I want you to understand that. And this goes back to it works with the prodigal son. The prodigal son, when he was out feeding the hogs, he said, what in the world am I doing? I can go back to my father's house, and I'll just go back as a servant because I'm not worthy to be a son, but I know I can go back because he is such a good man. This unrighteous steward had the same epiphany. When he got caught and he's trying to figure out what to do, he said, I know what I can do. I can steal from him again and take the money and make myself a place where I can go work after this, and he's not going to do anything else to me because he is that kind of master. He is that good and that kind. And Jesus is telling him, I'm sorry, Jesus says the master commended him for his shrewdness. The commendation was based on that knowledge. What a clever thing you did by playing on how good and kind I am, that you stole from me knowing that I wasn't going to do anything about it. That's how much God loves us, that he is willing. And I really thought about this. This is the last thing I wrote down, and I even looked up the word detriment to make sure that I was using it correctly. Jesus told these two parables to communicate the loving and merciful nature of God and that we can count on it. God will be merciful to us even to his own detriment. And I thought about that because when I preached this lesson at Rocky Point a couple of weeks ago, I stated that we can't hurt God. It's not like we can really steal from him. Analogies only go so far. We understand that. When we read the analogies in the Old Testament about Israel being the bride of God, we understand how that works, and we understand it doesn't go all the way so that, when God comes home, that Israel has dinner. It doesn't work like that. So, and analogies, metaphors, they only go so far. And I thought about that, and I think I said over there that, we can't hurt God. But as I was thinking about it today when I was kind of reworking it, I thought, you know what? God does love us to his own detriment, to his own being pained, being wronged, because he sent his own son to die for us. And that was more painful than any of us can imagine. But that's how much he loves us, that he was willing to do something even to that point. So I'm not going to stand here and be so arrogant as to say that now you know what that parable means. But that works a lot better for me. That explanation of it works a lot better for me, especially when you mentally take out that chapter division between the parable of the prodigal son and this one. And you got all those similarities that we talked about a few minutes ago. And then you see it in that light, that the servant was commended for being clever enough to play on how good the master was. It's kind of like the idea that Paul talks about the first verse of Romans 6. Shall we continue in sin that grace may abound? That's actually what this guy did. He continued in sin because he knew that grace would abound, because he knew what kind of master he was dealing with. That's the kind of master that we've got. Why wouldn't you serve him? Why wouldn't you obey him? There is no good reason. There's only good that will come from it, and nothing bad. It's a way to escape the trials of this life, the difficulties of it. Not to say that we won't still have them. We will. But it's a way to deal with them and manage them and receive mercy. And you can go to God and pray to him, and he will help you. If you disagree with what I said, please come and talk to me. I'd love to talk to you about it. Like I said, I'm not going to say that this has to be it, but it does make sense to me. If you have a communication that you need to make with the church, then tonight's the opportunity. Don't put it off. There's no need. Let's stand and sing.